Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is called Tharsis, and it's by a group called Son of the Widow. Well, I hope you had a nice Labor Day. Me? Well, I was slaving away at the computer getting my next book, Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology, off to the publisher. I'm hoping it will be out in early 2014. You know, in ancient times, Christianity was thought of by some as liberation theology. Slaves and the poor clung to it, and it inspired them to keep on enduring through their plight. You've probably heard Michael Fox and I talk about how people in Latin America were using Christianity as liberation theology, but the Reagan administration, the Vatican, and the CIA tried to thwart that. None of those folks wanted the masses empowered. Well, I'm trying to get people to realize the sacred feminine carries the message of liberation to thwart patriarchy, and that's what my book will be about. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll let you know when it comes out on the shelves. I might even read some excerpts now and then on the show. And if you missed hearing Professor Janet Binion last week discussing feminist polygamy and the women that kind of arrangement works for because of that technical glitch we were having here on Blog Talk last week, I want to let you know she's going to be back with us in October. She will be also discussing polyandry. So, turning our attention to tonight's show, first up we have Judy Foster calling in from Down Under, discussing her fantastic book, The Invisible Women of Prehistory, 3 Million Years of Peace, 6,000 Years of War, from Spinifex Press. We'll be chatting about matrilineal communities before the warrior culture, women's innovations during prehistory, and the evidence for this. This is a book you must have in your library, right alongside the Maria Gumbutas books. Then, Flash Silver Moon is back with us. She'll tell us what the cosmos has cooked up for us in the coming months. Then, when we cross the threshold into the second half of the show, Sherry Ruth Anderson will be discussing her book, Ripening Time. And our topic is The Feminine Face of God Grows Up, as we discuss the good things about aging. It's not all about loss and nursing homes and losing our memories. But let's get to Judy, because she's only able to be with us a short time. And let me tell you a little bit about her before we start our chat. Judy Foster is an artist and teacher of art. After studying at Monash University, a chance encounter with the book Language of the Goddess by Maria Gimbutas in 1993 inspired her to begin researching the origin and meanings of visual symbolism. She has two daughters and she lives in Melbourne, Australia. Invisible Women of Prehistory, the book that she's written with Marlene Derlett, a linguist, is a revolutionary book that challenges our preconceptions about the past. We often think of history as linear development, in which we are steadily moving out of a violent and patriarchal past to a more equitable and peaceful time. While we have no shortage of wars and the incidence of violence against women is alarmingly high, we are told that humans have never lived in such peaceful times. We continually hear that our predecessors were violent, but also that patriarchy is inevitable and universal. But what if none of this was true? What if we were descended from peaceful societies in which women were respected and equal to men? Would this inspire us to seek new ways of organizing our lives and of interpreting the past? Based on many years of research into ancient history and prehistory, Judy Foster and linguist Marlene Derlett take on the world. They argue that 3 million years of peace, a period when women's status in society was much higher than it is now, preceded the last 6,000 years of war during which men have come to hold power over women. They challenge the academic resistance to these ideas and re-examine both the archaeological work of Maria Gimbutas and recent research into the prehistories of Africa, East and South Asia, the Americas, Australia, Southeast Asia, and Oceania. What an incredible book. I have it in front of me, and I'm telling you, listeners, look for it. You will definitely want it. So, Judy, welcome to the show, and let me start off by saying thank you so much for your wonderful comments via email about my own book, Sacred Places of Goddess. That was quite an honor coming from a researcher such as yourself.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you.
So, Judy, I know we don't have a lot of time, so we're going to have to skim the surface here. I know there are people out there that don't want us to know or would have us not believe that there were peaceful communal matrilineal communities for 3 million years, but you say otherwise.
Yes. The
if you can speak up, Judy, I can't hear you very well.
Yes, there's evidence, plenty of evidence, that there wasn't any violence in prehistory. Because in archaeological reports, they say that there were no fortifications discovered in prehistoric settlements, villages or towns, no signs of kings, queens, or high chiefs, no war weapons in graves, and no sacrificial burial until the emergence and spread of the oppressive Indo-European practices, and that occurred only 6,000 years ago.
Okay. So where would some of these places be? Would Chateau Hayuk be one? Can you name others?
Yes, but there was evidence long before that, in the time of the caves, 32,000 years ago. It's really no evidence for any violence in paintings or sculptures or rock art of any kind, there's really more evidence of peaceful communities.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about some of those cave paintings, I think the most we usually see are maybe some hunting scenes or something like that that we think might have been shamanic or something of that nature. Is that right?
Yes, by can depict the hunt or other ritual happenings, or they can just depict everyday happenings, women and men going about their business.
Right. In a more egalitarian... You're thinking in a more egalitarian manner.
Yes. And that's really, that goes across the world for any art that we could find across the world into the hidden places like India and China and Southeast Asia. They were all peaceful. Quite extraordinary, really.
And of course, the
most famous places really are the civilizations of Setul Hoyuk and Ireland, the Minoans. They were all peaceful civilizations until the Indo-Europeans took over these regions after 6,000 years. They came out of southern Russia. They were horsemen who could move about very easily. And they just came in and asserted their own ways of living on the peaceful inhabitants who had no way to stop them, really.
Right. It was just sort of They were, you know, it makes me think of the Borg, you know, in Star Trek. You will be assimilated, kind of a thing. So you're saying Ireland, the Minoans of Crete, Chatelhayuk, and maybe even other places, but those are the three that you think stand out?
Yes, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but Megra in India, on the Indus River, on the Indian subcontinent, I should say, that was another place which was city, which was built before Harappa and Mohenjo-daro. It's not been talked about, but it was a city, just as the others were, and it had no signs of fortifications there. All that kind of violent happenings, the war weapons and things, all appeared after that date.
Now, you're saying Negra. Is that like, are you spelling that N-E-G-R-A? Because I'd like to look it up.
Oh, M-E-H-G-A-R-H.
M-E-H. G-A-R-H?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, you talk about some women's innovation during prehistory include agriculture, tailored clothing, the first writing. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I can tell you a little bit about it. I can say that the hunter-gatherers were more or less nomadic or semi-settled until near the Neolithic period, which was approximately between 12,000 and 10,000 years ago. And it lasted until the 6,000 years when the patriarchal period began. The people there were peaceful and they were communal and they ran their businesses with consensus, and the women and men each had their own rights and their own rituals and their own responsibilities. And it was in this climate, if you like, that women really invented quite a lot of things, but just some of them, which were, I think, surprising, was the very early use, and that probably goes back into 30,000 years, use of hides made into clothing, which was not just skins wrapped around people, but made into actual garments, stitched with bone needles and twisted thread made from certain plants, which were also later made for weaving cloth, and that was by 34,000 years ago. And then other innovations which I think are important was semi-agriculture, which was the hunter-gatherer women not picking all the plants, throwing seeds out around, maybe beginning accidentally so that other plants would grow. And they gradually, they provided more food for their people, and they built up areas of grasses and things which could be harvested. And that occurred around about around 12,000 to 15,000 years ago. And the development of the first writing, that was little clay, just little clay scraps with marks on them, which they put the marks on them to identify the amount of foodstuffs, because they had to they collected it. So, and it was, if it was centrally collected then and stored, then they used these little tiny clay tablets to identify the different foods. I don't know whether that's clear or not. That was, I suppose, it was a bit beside the invention of pottery, where pots, they made pots and different kinds of vessels for storage of food. And in the semi-agricultural period, they could collect seeds from the grasses, which they used to grind up and for food. And the different amounts of food they had to be stored with some form of identification.
Right, right. And down the road, I think I read somewhere, too, that it was, you know, women were the ones that were the inventors of animal husbandry. Do you agree with that as well?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think they did a lot of that, because we have to keep in mind that a good deal of the time the men would have to be away collecting more meat or fish or whatever, and that would take time. So the women did do a lot of that, yes.
So Judy, what has been the biggest challenge for you? Is it proving to people that your research is based in, you know, that you actually have evidence? I mean, what sort of evidence can we point to prove to this patriarchal society that, you know, things really were different if we look back far enough?
I do think that rock art and the architecture of villages were important in that regard, but it was what was found in graves and the little figurines which Maria Gimbutas speaks about. There were these little female figurines, little sculptures that you could hold in your hand, and they were made. She found lots in Europe. As when we started to look, we found that although archaeologists mention them in their reports, because they were female sculptures, they weren't. They didn't take much notice of them, so they weren't really recorded properly. But when we started looking at the evidence around, all the little images that have been, even the ones that have been photographed, and of course women, I think, are in the different countries are pointing out these little sculptures too. They are everywhere, and they point to ritual, and I think they report to the importance of women, because there were very few, if any, male sculptures during the prehistory. That's amazing, really, when you think about it.
Well, Judy, you know, one thing I think about, too, and I don't know if this is accurate. I'm just trying to look at this from a logical perspective. I mean, people's lives were not easy back then. They didn't have a lot of time to fool around with I don't know, amusements, I wouldn't imagine. You know, probably a lot of their lives were, you know, they've had to spend most of the hours of their day on you know, matters of survival, you know, feeding themselves, keeping themselves safe, keeping themselves warm, you know, feeding their children. I would imagine these artifacts, these figurines, had to be important to them for some reason, Otherwise, you know, they probably wouldn't have had the time to dedicate to creating them.
No, that's right. That's certainly right. And they were certainly, you could say, at the mercy of nature in many ways, and ritual was very important in that regard. But it's interesting that we're told that Australian Indigenous people, depending on where they were in Australia, actually had, there was a lot of food around for them, which was fairly easy to get. And so they did have time to develop rituals and to have their amusements and at the same time lead a fairly comfortable sort of existence, even though they had to move to follow the foods as they appeared, that's the vegetable foods. I don't know whether that answers your question or not.
No, I think it does. It probably varies from place to place, depending on the availability of food.
Well, it did, and the Native Americans would have had that similar experience, I think, depending on where they lived. But then again, you see, whether the little sculptures are found absolutely everywhere, I think they probably are, but depending on the time that they had to make them, they would, because they were important, but there would have been almost everywhere, or if they're not, you'd find they're decorated on pottery, which was a fairly important
Okay. Well, I know one of the things you wanted to make sure we made time to talk about was the changes that happened between prehistory and history. We didn't want to forget to talk about that.
No, that's right. No. Yes, well, I can tell you that Maria Gintas explains it. And she said it all began about 7,000 years ago in the heavily forested mountains of southern Russia. Life was fairly hard in that area because of the climate, apart from anything else. But they obviously weren't any other animals other than cattle and horses. And they had herds of wild horses, which they'd kept previously for just for milk and meat and clothing. But they began to tame them and ride them, which wouldn't have been easy. They were fairly tough people, I think. And around 6,000 years to 5,500 years ago, these groups of men started to ride the horses. They built up their herds, so they had ones to ride, and they needed more fuel for the horses, so they just decided to take over the lands of the Neolithic people, farmers who were nearby, and they just took over the lands, and they just killed those that they didn't want, and they stole women and children, and that was the beginning of women's downfall. They became just chattels, objects of exchange to be exchanged because there wasn't money at that stage. And they just gradually spread further and further across from that region through Eastern Europe and right across through where the, wherever there wasn't ice, of course, there was still land covered by ice at that stage. They went right across to England and to Ireland, and then he spread eastward to China and East Asia, Southeast Asia, and so on. It was all pretty drastic. They eventually, by about 4,000 years, they were right across the world. And I have timelines, which there are some in the front, which you'll notice, which gives a sort of general view. And then in the third, part three of the book, there are timelines for each country, each region, when all these changes took place. But they were pretty drastic.
So you're saying that the horse then was a real major influence that made this possible?
Yes, it was, because they could move very quickly. The maneuverability and the speed and the distance they could go was huge, really. I mean, they had cattle to pull carts, which carried their whatever goods and weapons and things that they wanted to use after them. But they just went ahead and, yes, just burnt and
Well, that makes sense, because I know I read a lot of stuff about Egypt, and one of the reasons some of the pharaohs became really powerful was because of the horse-drawn chariots. So, you know, having that to be able to have horses at your command, could set one people above another in terms of who was more powerful.
Ah, yes. Because the whole idea of power over other people really didn't begin until these men came out of southern Russia. You know, it just wasn't thought of. Nobody thought of killing anybody else deliberately or hurting anyone in that way. Taking people prisoner and as slaves.
And women as slaves and that sort of thing.
Yes. It just wasn't thought of. And,
right.
That was during the period after 6,000
right.
years.
Well, Judy, you know, I want to honor your limitations here because I know you said you couldn't speak to us very long. Is there, we're about at the point where you said, you know, we were going to have to cut it off, but is there anything else you wanted to make sure you wanted to share with listeners before you do have to go?
Yes, I just want to say that both Marlene and I, We just wanted people, well, other women really, but everyone to know that we just wanted to record that we found the reality of a peaceful and stable 3 million years before the historical period. That's absolutely correct, because and we believe that all women and men have the right to this knowledge, because if we know what it was like before history, is to know how to make changes in the future.
Right.
There is peace and equality between women and men, and between humans and the natural world. That's the other.
Right. Well, I know Heidi Geithner Abendroth has a book out on matriarchies and matrilineal societies, and I remember when I interviewed her, she told me the resistance that she had, not just in academia, but in society as a whole. It's like, you know, the man's world out there didn't want this to be talked about, you know. She was ridiculed and dismissed, and, you know, the sexism in academia is a real problem, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. Processual archaeology is a science too, very powerful. Stephen Pinker's a good, his book, Better Angels of Our Nature, A History of Violence and Humanity, you know, he's just keeping alive the fictional myth that humans are innately violent. And they weren't. They weren't until history, until the historic period. And I hope we've contributed towards that knowledge of that.
Well, you know what, Judy, you have made such an important contribution, and a book such as yours is an incredible feat. I know it took you years to research, and I know how hard it is to write a book of nonfiction like that. You have to practically research every paragraph, and it's incredibly difficult, incredibly tedious, but so important. And I just want to thank you for this wonderful contribution you've made to all of us, you know, to help us show the world that it doesn't have to be the way it is.
And we just hope that there'll be other women who'll carry on looking deeper into the subject. That was the other thing that was important.
I'm losing you there. Can you say that again, please, just a little bit louder?
We're hoping that other women will follow us and look further into the subject, because I think there's more there to know.
Okay. Now, getting your book, Judy, is it, I know Spinifex is an Australian publisher, but is it available on Amazon, or where can people find it if they're not in Australia?
It's certainly on Amazon. I looked it up. Yes, it's there. It should be now that the book is released in America. You should be able to get it through them. I don't know where else, but...
Okay. Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's got the gorgeous Venus of Willendorf on the cover, and it's just an incredible book, Judy. Thank you so much for all the time and effort I know you had to put into to, you know, make sure that information got between two covers. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And you're welcome back anytime. So if you'd like to talk more about this, Judy, you just pop me an email, okay?
Okay. Thank you. That's great.
All right. Good night, and thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Good night to America.
And America says good night to you down under. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, Judy. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. I'm sorry we couldn't have her on a bit longer, but her time was limited tonight. But what an incredible book. Definitely this is one you want sitting next to that Maria Gimbutas Language of the Goddess that I know you probably also have on your shelves. It's full of wonderful diagrams, and, you know, Judy being an artist and a teacher of art, of course, you know, that was important to her too, and she got that all right. Well, I believe Flash is on the line. Flash, are you there?
I certainly am.
Well, I want to say welcome back. It is so good to hear
from you
again.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know, it's been a while since you've been with us, and that wasn't your fault. That was mine. I sort of just fell out of the groove of having you with us every month. But I wanted to find out if you could look back over the summer and tell listeners, you know, what the stars predicted you know, that you think actually came true, that you were able to divine? What jumps out at you?
Woo. Well, I was more prepared to go forward, which I will do. But,
okay, well, I know you were, but I'm just, I guess I'm trying to make up lost ground.
Sure. Well, some of what's going on now was we've had several months of two kind of major energies, and one I've talked about at length at different occurrences, which is the Uranus-Pluto square, and that began, remember when Arab Spring began?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's when that aspect began.
Okay.
So we've been having that level of turmoil around the world where the institutions are being challenged big, very, very big.
And then here we have that all happening in Egypt all over again, too.
Yes.
Did that,
and that aspect,
was that something
yes.
you could see?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I mean, oh, goodness. The thing that was in Boston, I didn't predict what it was, but I predicted what the energy was,
mm-hmm.
and that there would be multitudes of lies about what really happened. And the lying has to do with Neptune being in Pisces as well as Chiron being in Pisces. And the level of deception that has been dealt to this country from the news media, the politicians, what have you.
Well, talk a little bit about that, Flash, because, you know, you and I hadn't been chatting, and I was busy and haven't been able to really follow your astro flash. What was the lies that we were being fed about the Boston Marathon bombing?
Well, about the fact that those two guys, yeah, they may have done it, but they were pawns in a much bigger game, in a much, much bigger game. And the fact that there were maneuvers going on, there were plans, so much was planned for an event. And so much, the same thing is going on now with Syria.
So let me ask you, are you saying that you think those two guys were really part of, say, Al-Qaeda, and, you know, the Obama administration just didn't want to say that? They wanted it to look like it was just these two lone, disgruntled guys? Or am I missing the point?
Well, you're getting part of it. You know, basically, we've been sold a bill of goods about so many things of that nature where, yes, look here, and then they'll keep us very busy watching day after day, week after week, the same clips, the same little pieces of information while something else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, and this was something that I absolutely had predicted about the explosion that happened in Texas within that same few days. And the news media was all about, look here, don't look there. And the people who owned the plant that blew up were, Monsanto owned that plant.
Oh, I don't think I knew that.
No, there's so much. When you find news clips going on and on and on, I mean, the amount that people were supposed to look at Miley Cyrus when Fukushima has boiling water.
Well, yeah, and I know they were trying to keep our attention off that all of those pipeline spills because you know, they want to do that pipeline through the United States, and you know, it's already broken in so many places, or ones similar to it. So it would point to how disastrous it would be if we did do that.
I
recall.
Neptune is in Pisces. Now, I'm a Pisces. I love Neptune. However, the good side of Neptune, which a lot of us are feeling, is this increased opening spiritually. And it's really a big time for us all to be enlightening up and dropping our crap, letting go of past things that impede us, and realizing how powerful the mind is to create a positive result.
Okay.
But that's the good side of it.
Right.
Because it really is very powerful.
So
we
like
don't...
the Snowden stuff, for instance, is that part of this revealing too as well?
It's very hard to know who's telling the truth on the right or the left.
Yeah.
And, I mean, talk about crazy. We have the right sounding like peaceniks because Obama wants to go to war.
Well,
crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, this whole Syria thing just sounds like Iraq all over again. I'm sorry, no matter how Jim, not Jim Kerry, not Jim Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry couches it, it still feels like the same old shit to me.
It is.
You know?
It's bait and switch.
I can't, even though it's coming from Obama and it's coming from the left, I'm not buying it.
Good. Good. Because we can't have smart people swallowing the Kool-Aid because it's packed in a Democratic package.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Chris Hayes was talking about that tonight, you know, and it just, you know, it just seems like craziness. And, you know, you wonder, could it be as obscene as just more money for the military-industrial complex, or is there a bigger game afoot?
That's a pretty big game right there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really. I mean, how can anybody think that bombing people because their leaders are bombing them makes any sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, Chris Hayes was saying the money of that each drone strike or whatever you call it, each bomb, whatever, is so much money. I think it added up to like $280 million. And why not use that money for all the people that have been displaced from Syria? You know,
right.
To help them, you know, help them start their lives again. You know, humanitarian, you know, use the money for humanitarian aid, not more destruction.
Well, let's take this conversation back like 40 years. Remember the good old 60s? Well, actually the late 60s, early 70s. The astrology, very similar. Uranus and Pluto were conjunct then. Now they're square. Chiron was in Pisces. Now we've got Chiron in Pisces again. So some of the issues were the same in that there were wars that a lot of people didn't want, and there was a growing consciousness that at the time, you know, we were being downloaded. When we're sitting in the mud at Woodstock, as I was, and I experienced the feeling of a download there. Totally experienced it. I heard the music of the spheres before any of the music started. And there is a consciousness of that time that was embedded in some people. Some people forgot. Some people held it somewhere. And it was meant to be stirred up. We weren't able to manifest it quite yet. A few things were manifest. The fact that we have a feminist movement, we have an environmental movement, that some of the things that have happened for women and for gays, and, of course, the civil rights movement, a lot of stuff got started then. But this is the time with the square to bring all that into focus and to manifest the ethic and the dynamism and the beliefs of that time. You know, when people start being really mean, part of it's because the inner belief is that people are essentially evil. And, you know, I'm kind of tagging on to what the woman before me was talking about, that there is a core of goodness in people, even though we will see hellacious things done. We have to believe that there is an essential goodness, and that from there we can bring these positive energies, these positive beliefs, because this is the flip side of Neptune, and it's also what the radical Uranian Plutonic energy is trying to do. It's trying to make profound change in everybody's life. Hmm. It's like, never mind what you thought was security. How secure are you now trying to fight for this and fight for that, and your human rights are going down the toilet.
Right, right.
You know, it's really a time of facing certain facts of what is real security and what isn't.
Right, and right. And like with all the NSA stuff, you know, how many liberties are we giving up under the guise of security, you know?
Right, right.
So Flash, we probably have about 15 minutes left.
Okay.
So what's ahead? You know, what is the cosmos saying we should be looking for in the next, you know, next little while here?
Okay, a few things. One, in terms of, like, predictions, et cetera, because this is ongoing, and some of it's really good, and some of it's really challenging. We've been having, if you notice, a little bit of water issues, and that's because we've had a grand trine in water signs.
Wait, what water issues? What water issues?
Well, flooding, all over the place.
Okay.
All over the place. People having more rain in some places than they've had in 100 years. Places that have never flooded. And on and on. Water being damaged by the oil and the corrects. Water being damaged by the frackers.
Right.
Corporations working to sell water. They're collaborating to figure out how they can drain water from being our lifeline to being their moneymaker.
Right.
So there's all those water issues that have been going on for quite a while and will probably go on for a bit longer. But here's a really, really uplifting thing about what some of the scientists have done. Because along with rebellion, we also have more science working in a good way, not just because they can, but actually for something real and positive. And this comes out of Ireland, actually. And when I talk about these aspects, these are slow movers. This isn't something that tomorrow you can count on a good day. These are more global and longer lasting. This came from Ireland. And if you want to read more about it, it's at www.independent.ie. And it's also on my Astroflash. The whole story is there on my website, flashsilvermoon.com. But basically, what they've done, and it was tested extensively, and it is liable, I don't know if you've seen it on Facebook, but it's liable to put the GMOs out of business.
Really?
It's liable. I mean, Monsanto stock is, all the big guns are selling their stock.
I saw that. I saw that on Facebook yesterday. They had pictures of these poor little rats filled with tumors and about how all the executives from Monsanto were selling their own stock.
Yes.
Do you think that means there's going to be some kind of revelation pretty soon? That's why they're dumping it before it's worthless?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, Europe doesn't want it. A lot of countries won't have it.
Right.
They're scamming us here because the people haven't had the guts to say no.
Right.
And we've got bad lobbies. But anyway, this new thing, it's using water and technology, and it's using radio wave energized water, and it massively increases the output of vegetables, fruit, and there's no need for bug juice.
Huh.
They're disease-resistant, and it means huge savings on fertilizer and pesticides. It's been tested extremely well.
Oh, that'll put the Koch brothers out of business.
Yeah, it's going to make GM obsolete, and it also addresses the global warming fear that there is too much carbon dioxide in the air by simply converting excess CO2 into edible plant mass.
Wow. Well, that
awesome?
Is huge. That's
Is
huge.
That awesome?
But, you know, look, I'm a cynic. And it scares me to death that the people who are creating this are going to disappear, you know?
Well, there is that. There is that. And I hope, for all our sakes, that they've got military around them.
Yeah.
you know, just protecting their asses, because that is how things go, and that is a, it is cynical, but it's also reasonable.
Right.
Because
right.
we've seen this. The only reason we do not have free energy, every single one of us, is because they bumped off Tesla.
Right. Yeah, my husband
so
says that too. Yeah.
It's true. It's true. So instead of free energy, we've got HARP. Whoopee.
Right. Right.
Whoopee. And so, you know.
Okay, so we got that water. That we got that water. That's hopeful.
Yes.
Or Ken, or what else are you seeing? You think we need to know?
Well, between the 14th and 19th of this month, we're going to have kind of a pressure cooker effect. So we want to keep our eyes open. And it's always like you're going to have some kind of Earth-type disaster and a political one. It's like as above, so below. We're usually going to see, if something blows big, it blows big on a couple of fronts. And, you know, back in the day, the weathermen used to say, oh, you know, they're seeding the clouds, they're doing this, they're doing that. And some of it is true.
Yeah.
That they do a disaster to cover up the other disaster.
Yeah, yeah, to distract us.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a big thing of hide and seek. Look over here, look over here, look over here. Meanwhile, someone's busy over there.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, old news guys like Cronkite are rolling over in their graves of what's being called news these days.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's sad. But, you know, there are some up things, too. Now, what's interesting is the planet Jupiter, which is the planet of expansion, is sitting right on the United States sun. The sun in anybody's chart is their essence. So the good news with that is the economy should be a lot better.
Hmm, okay.
The bad news is that people running the joint feel like they can do anything they want because they've got this big bolstering energy and can kind of bully wherever they want to. Even if everybody's saying, no, 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 say, oh, we can handle that. And then you've got the deception level of Neptune covering what's the real deal, what's really happening.
Well, you know, with the economy, though, you know, I keep hearing that the only jobs that are really being created are low-level, you know, minimum wage jobs. So, I mean, I guess, are you saying you think things are going to, you know, get better beyond that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And I've usually been pretty on with that. You know, if you follow the patterns of Jupiter and Saturn, you can see, because Jupiter's expansion and Saturn's contraction.
Okay. Okay, and, well, I don't know where the jobs are going to come from, but as long as they come from somewhere.
Well, you know, they may come from green energy.
Yeah.
They very well may. Because, you know, there's some positive things, but one of the most important things to kind of take home with you, if the news says, or I say, or somebody says, well, there's going to be just terrible, terrible fires all across California, and they're not going to stop till they burn the place down. So you hear something like that. And anyone who's responsible, as I am, would say, even if that was said, even if that is what energetically looks like is going to happen, you get a whole bunch of people, the more the merrier, to see California having nice rain, just the right amount.
Right.
Not
right.
So much that you have landslides.
Yeah.
You know, just the right amount. And you spread it like wildfire over the computer, and you get everybody praying for the same thing.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have the bad news.
Yeah, so we create our own reality with our,
absolutely,
you know, with our intentions.
And it's more and more and more true. We are both more psychic and more powerful in that realm than we've ever been. And so those wise women that are around here need to be picking up their act and saying, okay, I sure as hell don't like rapists in the neighborhood. Let's do an anti-rape spell. Let's,
mm-hmm,
you know, let's make sure the water stays clean. Pick a thing. There's
right,
loads of things to take part in and gather as many people as you can. As I, you know, try to communicate about some of these harsher things that I see or just know about them, all of a sudden I just feel heart sick. And by accident, if there are any of those, my finger went over something on my timeline, and I've got this gorgeous music all over. And music is very Neptune, too. And I felt so good, and I was seeing the animals on the video that I'd been hearing about and crying over, and suddenly I felt elevated. I felt wonderful. And I said to myself, oh, yeah, remember, you're a musician, Flash. Hello. Let's do a moon jam, get everybody you know and people who do what they can in their cities, and do one on Friday the 13th. And let's take care of the water.
Yeah, we forget how powerful we are. You know, I think we need to remind ourselves over
Absolutely.
And over and over again.
Yeah, because I went from like crying to feeling elated. And, you know, I just knew, okay, you want to know this, you want to share this stuff, and you need to do everything you can to raise the vibration to make these dark stories in the land to be inhospitable, to be toxic. We can do that. We change
okay.
the vibration. We change everything.
Okay. So so you were saying you think between the 14th and the 19th, that's why you're saying on Friday the 13th, do something like this.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and music is very, very powerful.
Okay.
You know, take your pick. Use the kind you like.
Right.
Not everybody has to be a genius at it, but do something harmonious.
Right, right. Well,
you know, some will listen, some will...
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Anything else for the rest of the month?
Yeah, let's see. Toward the end of the month, the 20th, I believe it is, yeah, that's when Pluto goes direct. It comes out of the underworld, and it's been kind of causing revolutionary energies and, you know, sometimes destructive energies, but very powerful energies. It's all been kind of underneath. And when it goes direct on the 20th, things that may have been kind of on a holding pattern are apt to start happening. Also, we've got a full moon in Pisces, and that's on the 19th. And that should be very, very interesting, too. We'll be more able to see the big picture. And that's a very important thing because we've had a lot of Virgo energy this month. And Virgo opposite Pisces, that's like Earth opposite water. And the material opposite spiritual. So we're learning to integrate. That's a big lesson all month, integration. And so that we're neither too fixated on the minutiae or drowning in just the massive all.
Yeah, more
so we
want
to be able to, yeah, absolutely, more integration, more balance. And with Saturn and Venus together, we might be seeing more solidity in relationships because part of what's been going on for months is challenges in the relationships. And if they're supposed to bust up, they do, and they should, because we're all trying to liberate ourselves from old dogmas and places where we're stuck. So now Venus and Saturn, which is more of a cuddling up energy, more getting things settled and rooted, is coming through. And so we might be feeling some of the settling and grounding where there's been a lot of turbulence.
Okay.
So, you know, some of the energy is about shaking it up, but I'd say the most important thing is for people to be willing to move their energies toward the power of love, not the love of power.
Right, right, absolutely. Well, that's the goddess way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really is.
So if you had to guess, you know, based on what you see, do you think we're going to do something with Syria, or you think we're going to back away?
I think we're going to be forced to back away, I'm thinking probably for a good part of this month. And I think if Obama tries to just kind of jump over everybody, because nobody's standing with him,
right?
Except for what's his face, John.
Yeah, it's like Bush all over again. I can barely believe he's doing this.
It's like, who are you?
Yes, yes.
Who are you? What did we get sold?
Right.
And
or who's, you know, I always think,
who's,
you know,
pulling your strings?
Who's pulling your strings? Who's manipulating you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing I always think. You know, it's like, or do they tell him, you know, if you don't do this, we're going to kill your family, kind of a thing?
Those,
you know,
all sound like my words. They all sound like my words. Every last one.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, we know there are evil people like that out there.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, yes. They're called the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're
and beyond
their
bank
book. Their bank book and their, you know, their power mongering is at stake. You know, I mean, here we're out of Iraq. You know, Afghanistan is going to end pretty soon. You know, who are they going to, you know, how are they going to make money?
Yeah, there's bloodlust behind that oil.
Yeah.
And,
well,
you know,
Flash, anything else you want to leave listeners with?
Well, no matter how you do it, the most important thing any of us can do, whether it's good out there, whether it's bad out there, is to keep raising our vibration and gathering as many people as you can with you to do that in whatever way that you choose to, because the people do have the power. We absolutely do. We can't forget it, and we can't get just droned into silence and just checking out.
Yeah.
We need to check in.
Well, you know, I am heartened that there are so many people who are speaking out against this Syria thing. You know, I really am. You know, maybe we did learn something from George Bush.
Yeah.
So.
And the thing is, the energies are not a reenactment of the Bush years. They're a reenactment of the late 60s, early 70s. And there is a spirit that does want us to make love, not war.
Yeah.
There absolutely is that vibration that is trying for that. There are the right ingredients to do better.
Okay. Well, Flash, why don't you go ahead and tell listeners how they can keep up with your Astro Flash and, you know, if they'd like to follow you?
Yeah. My website is flashsilvermoon.com, and I do a monthly Astro Flash and a newsletter. So if you would like to be on that e-list, you can either go to my email, which is flashsilvermoon@gmail.com, or you can go to my website, which has all kinds of goodies on it. I wrote the Wise Woman Tarot. You might like to interest yourself with that, and that's at flashsilvermoon.com. And you can also find me, Flash Silvermoon, on Facebook. I also have an animal page now. And I've got a radio show, actually thanks to you, introducing me to Lillian over there, called What the Animals Tell Me. That's on powertalk.com.
Okay. Well, Flash, thank you so much for coming back, and we will certainly have you on more regularly now if you have the time. And
we'll try to get back
to that a bit.
Yep. You just tell me when, and I'll be there.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very
good
welcome.
Good night, and, you know, hope you have a good month.
I do, too. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, stay tuned with us. Next up is Sherry Ruth Anderson discussing The Feminine Face of God Grows Up. But right now, we are about ready to cross the threshold into the second half of the show. And in doing that, I have a word from Joe Carson for you.
Most people see humankind as really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree. And I came out of it. This is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, that's those mountains, tall backs. Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are some of the opening words from the DVD, Dancing with Gaia. It's a wonderful film about goddess, sacred sexuality, connecting with the earth, and ways to actually do that. It gives you tools to connect in a real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. You can learn more about connecting with the landscape of goddess, both internally and externally. It's also visually stunning. The DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, too, and all of that for only $20 from dancingwithgaia.com. And Joe Carson, I hope you will consider checking it out. And the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference is this weekend in Malibu. I will be there on Saturday. I'll be leading the lunch blessing and giving a presentation called Go Goddess, talking to you about leading a goddess-inspired life from your early years to the voting booth and beyond. Then I'll be priestessing in the temple for a while. So I hope if you're there, you'll come say hello. And Femme the Movie, I've been talking to you about that on and off for a while, the documentary called Femme, Women Healing the World. There are screenings happening all over the country in September. One is coming up in L.A. next week. Another will be on Saturday the 21st. I believe there might also be one soon in San Francisco. You can actually hold your own screening in a local theater. If you go to TUGG.com, you can find out more. You can even use the documentary as a fundraiser. The executive producer, Emmanuel ATA of Wonderland Entertainment Group, he wants to saturate the mainstream with the wisdom that's incorporated in this film, Femme, Women Healing the World. So for more information, either email me or contact the producer yourself. This film, by the way, was executive produced by Sharon Stone. And you can find out more at the website wonderlandentgroup.com, wonderlandentgroup.com. Well, okay, it's about time to chat with Sherry about aging gracefully and the good things about growing older. Let me tell you just a little bit about Sherry, and then we'll chat. Sherry Ruth Anderson writes and teaches about spiritual development with a special interest in women's experience and aging as awakening. Her books include the best-selling The Feminine Face of God and The Cultural Creatives. Her recent short documentary is A Woman's Descent to the Sacred. And if you like what we talk about tonight or any of those books sound interesting, her website is her name, SherryRuthAnderson.com. So, Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for your efforts out there. I'm really interested in your other books, too. You know, maybe sometime we can chat about them a little bit, and do a show. But now, now you've written something for maybe the crone, the woman as she ages, so that, we don't feel like, our later years or just, filled with what, nursing homes and Alzheimer's and all of that negative stuff we always hear is associated with growing older. You have a different story to tell.
Well, I have a different perspective. And as you know, my new book is called Ripening Time, The Inside Stories for Aging with Grace. And I gave you a title for what you and I could talk about, is sort of with a smile on my face, of the feminine face of God grows up, because when I wrote with my friend Pat Hopkins, The Feminine Face of God, that was that came out 20 years ago, and I was 50, and now I'm 70. And so the question is, okay, you know, once you really have a change in the culture where you're recognizing that women's spirituality is here to stay, and that, you know, we have so much wisdom and depth that's developing, and that we're sharing it with each other and exploring together, then the question of aging, I think, becomes extremely interesting. Because, well, maybe I could tell you that when I started to tell people that I was really interested in aging and I was writing a book about it, they would get this really bored look on their face, and they would go, "Oh, how interesting! Excuse me, I just saw somebody I know right now." So I thought, I got to find a better title. And so I started thinking about all the different names that are given to who you are as you grow older. All these horrible names, you know, golden agers and senior citizens. And and ones I don't even want to mention here, that they're just, as soon as you hear them, you want to yawn and walk out.
Well, and so many of us, you know, are baby boomers who now are there, you know, and we may still wear tennis shoes and, you know, running suits and, you know, we're maybe, and, you know, you think about all the rock bands, you know, you look at the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. I mean, you know, they're all ripening.
Well,
you know,
you
watch some of these musicians, and you know, you almost hate to even look at them because you want to remember them the way they were in the 70s or the 60s, you know, and you know, now they look like your grandpa.
Well, you know, the problem isn't so much what they look like, it's what you see in the mirror, in the bathroom mirror when you get up in the morning. Do you think that what you look like and what your ideas are about growing old? And our ideas aren't just our ideas, of course, they're what we you know, take in from the culture, and all the ideas about the culture. So I thought maybe I would tell you a little bit about how I came to even be willing to look at this and write this book.
Okay, okay. And how you came up with the title, too, because I love the title, you know, ripening time. You know, when you hear the word ripening, I mean, that's when fruit is at its sweetest, juiciest, you know. I mean, it's a very positive perspective.
You know, it's interesting. When I sent the book out to various people to, you know, endorse and write comments on, I got some comments back initially that said, well, you know, I don't know. I really ripening time, right? Isn't ripening time like when you're in your 40s and 50s? And so we have all these ideas in our culture about what ripening means.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking around and I looked up in the dictionary, you know, and I came up with this idea of the possibility of ripening, because exactly as you say, it's a process. It's a maturing. Cheese ripens. Grapes ripen into wine. Good wine is made from mature grapes. So I looked up in the dictionary, and ripen comes from the old English word dating back 10 centuries to the word to reap. Now, what does it mean to reap, if you think about it, from a long life for people who are deeply engaged in loving the earth, in spirituality, and in being conscious and being curious about who we are and what the deep truths of our life can be. If you already are living from that truth, of that level of exploration, of discovery, of honesty with yourself, then you begin to be curious about what it actually means to reap the benefits of a conscious long life.
As I'm hearing you say that, I'm thinking about, we think about the harvest time of the year, after all the toil of, we're talking metaphorically here, obviously, but, we're sort of at the wheel of the year is sort of agriculturally, themed. You've worked through the summer and the spring to plant your seeds, and you finally get to harvest and, enjoy the abundance of your toil. And that's a good thing, I mean, who wants to be 20 years old anymore where you don't know anything and you don't know who you are and you have all of that awkwardness? I mean, I think this time of life, you're liberated from so much baggage. I mean, don't you think?
I think there's two sides. I think you're absolutely right. And there's another side to it, if you will, what you could call the dark places of wisdom. So one question that you could come up with as you think about, well, how does maturing really happen? It's not just living a long time. It's actually being present to the difficult, challenging, heart-rending times of life, as well as the really sweet ones.
So it's a deepening, I think you're saying. A deepening?
It's a deepening. Now, one of the things I think that's outstanding for people about what it means to grow old is that not only are we going to die, but the people around us are going to die. Alzheimer's, dementia, diminishment of certain capacities in various ways. All those things are like forbidden in our culture to talk about in ordinary conversation. That's why people walk away. But in fact, that's what spirituality really allows you to engage and confront in your experience. And as you come to the deep places of wisdom, that's what matures us. It's not like an accident. It's not like everything's good and then, you start to have losses and then it's really sad and it's over. It's like, no, those are what the great Jungian psychologist, one of the great Jungian psychologists called the gifts reserved for age. And you think about gifts. How could you call losses a gift? Well, they're the gifts reserved for age, because what ripens us is being able to be present to those depth times in our lives. And that's why I think that's why shows like yours are so important. Any ways of really conscious women meeting together, listening to each other, supporting each other, to be with the truth of what their experience is. And the from the women's movement, the notion that we can hear each other into speech. I think we can hear each other into wisdom if we deeply listen to each other, we deeply support each other. Tell me, how is it for you? What's happening for you? That allows us to digest and metabolize what's happening. And that's where the maturing comes from.
Well, you know, as I'm hearing you say this, Sherry, you're reminding me of people I've had on my show who talk about how important it is to not, you know, turn away when we have to talk about other difficult things, you know, whether it be, you know, maybe sexual assault or something like that. I mean, just the talking about it gives others permission to talk about it too, so that it becomes something that we, you know, that isn't hidden below the surface in society, that it becomes more mainstream, that, you know, we can all benefit from the conversations. Is that part of what you're talking about as well?
Yes, and I really believe that when you can be present to your own dark places of wisdom, to your own difficult times, then you are an incredible resource for all those around you, and you never have to talk about it, as a matter of fact, because people recognize it. People come up. I have a friend who's been through great difficulties, and she's a professor of television at UC Berkeley, and she said, when I first came there, women would come up to me, the young women students, and they'd start to tell me things that they said they'd never told anybody. And I'd say to them, how did you know that you could tell me? And they said, we just know. We know that you're able. We see how you walk. We see how you sit. We see how you listen. We knew we could talk to you. So I think if you listen to people, and you can even think about who would you consider from your childhood someone who you recognized as an elder,
right?
Meaning just old, but someone that you felt that person knows something wise.
Because let's face it, probably some people go through all their lives and never really find wisdom. You know, they sort of stay in that sort of shallow pool. But you know, you're talking about something totally different. You know, it's not just the fact that your number age is older. You know, you've actually ripened and deepened.
Yes, it's not a number.
It's not a number. You know, you actually have something of value and understanding to offer those around you.
So one thing that comes up from what you were just saying is the question of, well, what is wisdom, really? What do we mean by wisdom? We're not talking about just, you know, knowing information. One of the things that I get really pissed off about is there are books coming out now by people who are interviewing kind of basically famous old men, I'd have to say, and they're assuming that these people are wise elders because they're old and they're famous. And if you read interviews with these people, you go, my goodness, this person is really selfish. My goodness, this doesn't seem to be capable of caring about anybody except, I don't know, his own reputation. And begin to ask yourself, what is wisdom? How do I recognize someone that I feel, did I even know anyone as a child? Do I know people now who I consider to have a life wisdom, a digested, rich understanding that doesn't necessarily have to be what they say, but how they listen?
Mm-hmm.
The quality of presence that they bring wherever they are.
Right. You really, hear you describing it, it's really beautiful. You know, something, you know, we should covet, something we should aspire to be, you know. I think, you know, maybe especially women, because, you know, older women are not valued in our society, you know, and this can shift that. I mean, I know in women's spirituality, you know, we're more cognizant of that and we're trying to change those things. You know, that's why we revere our elder crones and, you know, we have croning ceremonies and things like that, you know, to try to do things differently than patriarchy would have us do, you know, in devaluing, you know, the older woman. I mean, look at Hollywood. They never know what to, you know, unless you're Helen Mirren, you know, there's no one,
right,
you know, can get a part in Hollywood, you know, if you're an older woman. You know, they just don't know, you know, they can't even imagine what that archetype is.
I want to come back to what you said a little bit earlier about the value that we can recognize in older women, and tell you a little story of so for many years I've been doing elders salons and elders circles and elders seminars and all of. For women, for men and women, all different kinds, for maybe the last 20 years. And I was doing a group about a year or two ago, locally, a relatively small group of men and women, and we were doing inquiries into things that interested us about growing old and exploring our own experience. And there was one man who always asked afterward if he could get a ride to the bus station, which was rather far away. And everybody, you know, would kind of volunteer one person at a time, and they were quite willing to drive him to the bus station. And finally I got around to asking him, where do you actually come from? And he came from a place that was quite far away, and he had to take a bus to get there, and then he walked several miles to where our meeting was. He didn't have a car. And so, you know, we all got quite curious, and we said, how come you bother to come to our meeting? And he said, to tell you the truth, I tried to start a group for men who were, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, where we could have deep discussions about what it means to grow old. And in the beginning, the groups were always full, and the men were very enthusiastic. And then we got to the hard stuff, and they started dropping like flies. And pretty soon, nobody would come to the meetings. And he said, to tell you the truth, I think we needed to have women with the men, because the men didn't know how to be with the hard stuff, how to look at it, how to honestly talk about what they were feeling, and how to listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we need each other to be able to do that.
Yeah. Wow, that's a good story. And, you know, when you think about it, that's sort of the story of men and women, you know, in generalities, of course. You know, it's always the women that are going to sit and talk about things. You know, the men just don't ever really learn how to do that, do they? At least not many of them.
You know, we probably can't generalize that widely like that, but there certainly is a trend in our culture against, do we have the time? I have another story that you
sure,
might enjoy.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
So I have a dear friend who I'll call Harry, and Harry's very handsome. And he used to be very handsome when he was young, I gather, from looking at pictures. And now he's bald, and he has these very beautiful blue eyes. And he and I go for walks from time to time in the marsh near my house. So when I started working on the idea that I wanted to write a book about what it was like to grow old, and I wanted to write it in my own voice and tell stories from my own, you know, direct experience, I told Harry about it. And so we're going for this walk, and he says to me, honestly, I don't know why you're interested in this aging thing. It's really not relevant for people like us. So Harry and I are exactly the same age. And at this point, we were both 65. And I go, really? And I start to wonder, what does people like us mean? And he goes on to tell me that he's as slim as he was when he was young, and he still, you know, is watching for moments of beauty through his life, and he's a poet and a writer and a very accomplished guy. And I'm still thinking about, what does people like us mean? Maybe it means I'm sort of exotic and glamorous like he is. That wouldn't be bad. Maybe that's what it is. And so, I can't think of anything to say to him, to even ask him about what people like us means. And so, as we walk on, he turns and he says, "You see, age has nothing to do with it." So, I'm sort of puzzling over this and wondering, what does that mean? People like us. People like us. And I realized that I think he means like beautiful, fit, lucky people who manage to still be pretty healthy at 65 and still have their wits about them. And I realized I want to be like that. I don't want to be old like my grandparents were. So, and I realized I'm really holding on to this idea. But in the meantime, I've been invited to this very interesting thing called Women Speak, which is a gathering of about 1,000 women. At this time, it was in Mobile, Alabama, in the convention center. And there are women from all across the South, and about half of them are on scholarships. So they're working-class women, middle-class women, and women from homeless shelters. And I'm doing two workshops called something about becoming the new elders. And so in the workshops, I begin them by giving a little talk about how the invitation is there now for us to become elders and what does that mean. And then I take a microphone and I start walking around and I say to the women, an individual woman, tell me a lie about growing old. And so this woman stands up and she says, your grandchildren will adore you just as you've always dreamed, and they'll want to come and spend every holiday with you. Everybody starts to laugh. And then I ask another woman, tell me a lie about growing old. She says, growing old means you get to be stupid and helpless. Silence. Tell me a lie about growing old. And so I start passing the mic around, and pretty soon the women are standing up. Every one of them has something to say. Every one of them has something about the way the culture portrays aging, and, you know, of course, aging in women, but not just aging in women. And pretty soon, they don't even wait for the microphone. They're standing up and they're shouting. And by the end of that, I feel like I know what kind of people I want to be counted among. I want to be counted among women like this, who want to tear off the coverings of what it means to grow old, and want to look at the lies that our culture tells, and want to tell the truth to each other. What's it like now? What are you discovering?
Yeah. And not to pretend that, you know, it's all, you know, that it's not difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't want to pretend that to each other. Why would we lie to each other?
Yeah, because
we don't want to lie to ourselves anymore.
But then, by the same token, like you said earlier, you know, there are some wonderful things about it as well. So maybe have a more balanced approach.
So I could add to that too. You know, I think about. Sometimes I think about how things are now, and if I could possibly tell myself, if I could have told myself when I was 30 or even 40 what it's like now, and if myself would have understood, and I don't know if it could be possible, because the way things are now, I feel content and happy so much of the time, and that means I'm sitting at the breakfast table watching the bluebirds, the blue jays fight at the bird feeder, and my husband's doing his email, and I'm drinking tea, and I'm really happy. I'm really content. But I thought were like separate moments, separate events. They all have more of like a continuity and a flow, and life feels very precious now. I had a cancer diagnosis about 5 years ago, and I'm fine now. But that really helped me to know how precious life is, and yeah. how much it means to be right here, to have these moments, to love life as it is.
And to appreciate those simple moments and not take them for granted,
too.
It's
so rich.
Yeah.
And part of that, research has shown, actually, that when you know that an ending is near, the time that remains is so precious.
Yeah.
There's a poignancy to life that, I mean, that has to do not just with death, but with endings.
Well,
and
I'm thinking,
so
too, Sherry, you know, my husband just had a heart attack in July. So, you know, I came face to face with, you know, things that I hadn't really thought about, you know, I felt were, you know, just years off. And it's almost a gift when something... something like that happens, in a way, when you're faced with mortality, because I think it does make you appreciate things that you normally just sort of take for granted.
I think it's exactly what you're saying. And what I said before about that phrase, the gifts reserved for elders, and you, it's almost a gift because you know, right, how precious your time is with him.
Right, right, right. You have that wisdom now, you know, that you didn't have before. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it isn't that it doesn't go away. I mean, it isn't that it, like, stays all the time, but it's there more and more.
Yeah, you have
but
those glimmers.
Necessarily. See, that's why I think we need each other so much, because it's not necessarily like that. Some people, my friend Jim Thomas, let me see if I can find it, because I wrote about it in the book. He had this wonderful phrase to describe what it's like. Let me see if I can find it for you. I don't see it here. He said, we're, in a way, we're like wild apples. And some of us ripen and mature, and some of us stay small and bitter. And the question is, yeah, exactly, how can we let life ripen us?
Right.
What can we provide in our own lives and for each other to allow the events that happen to all of us, to allow those to ripen and mature us so that we feel that preciousness that you were describing?
Mm-hmm.
Or else we feel like my mother felt, don't tell me. I don't want to know the sad stuff. I can't stand it. And I would say, did you call your friend? No, I don't want to hear what's happening with her. And so she got smaller.
Right, right.
Somebody else can get bigger, but I think we need each other. I think we can really help each other very much. But it's not to say we should. It's to say we can, if we have the resources if it's possible for us. And sometimes, at times in our lives, it's not possible. It's too hard.
Yeah, maybe it's overwhelming, or like with in the case of your mother, something, you know, it just seemed to feel like too much for her.
Yeah, she said when she was 11, it was like 1929, and her friends' fathers were jumping out of windows, and she just couldn't bear it. Nobody could bear it. A lot of people who grew up in those years said, you know, what you have to do is you always look for the bluebird of happiness, and you turn your face away from what's sad because it's too overwhelming. And that was, you know, whole generations had that kind of experience. A lot of people like us, the baby boomer generation, and the ones, you know, a little bit ahead of us, we've had a different kind of experience. And
right.
We might have more resilience.
Mm, it's lovely, lovely, lovely. And very astute, very astute. Well, before we have to wrap it up, is there anything else you'd like to share that maybe we didn't get a chance to say, Sherry?
Well, it depends on the time. Tell me how much time we have.
Maybe we have about
three
or 4 minutes.
Or do we have 1 minute?
About 3 minutes.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll tell you how I came to write the book and why I called it The Feminine Face of God Grows Up. So I didn't have any idea about writing about getting old. But I was in a yoga class, and this beautiful blonde woman comes up to me and says, I heard that you led a ritual of on the Colorado River for elders, and I'm 49 years old, and I'm going to turn 50, and I want to have an elder ceremony for my birthday. So will you help me? So I said, okay. So we talked, and I gave her a couple ideas. And then she emailed me a couple weeks later, and she said, actually, I'd really like to talk some more to you. Will you come to my houseboat? She lives on a houseboat in the Sausalito in the San Francisco Bay. So I went over to see her. And we had this long talk, and it seemed like it really wasn't going anywhere. And then she said, is there a map for growing old? And I had this feeling like that was a wake-up call that I couldn't turn away from. And, you know, if you've ever had this feeling like you've been in a foreign airport and you're paged, and suddenly, you know, you wake up, it felt like that. And over the next couple months, we became friends and walked and talked. And then she kept bringing that up. Is there a map for growing old? And finally, I said to her, you know, I don't have a map. I'm just finding my own way step by step. But I have something. And I think you could call it a compass. So she was interested, and she said, well, what do you have? And I said, I have questions. And I think she must have looked at me like I was a little crazy. And I thought I'd better add, what I have are soul-level questions. I know how to let the questions find me, and I know how to help people open to their own deep questions. And that's compass. And really, I think a compass is better than a map. So that's why I wrote the book.
Well, you know, and it makes me think about something I learned some time ago. You know, sometimes knowing what questions to ask is really the key to everything, isn't it?
I think there's something about I guess I'd have to call it listening for your own questions,
mm-hmm.
and that those questions might not come in words at all. They might just come in a kind of puzzlement or a not knowing but longing to know, and you're sort of led in a certain kind of direction. So it's really an opening to your own guidance. And I believe it's really important as you start to feel your way into what's a question for you at that level, at that soul level, not to give your question away to anybody else, like not to go to some expert and go, you know, what's the answer to my question or to my dream? Because I think the questions really open our own guidance to us.
Okay. Well, listeners, you are listening to Sherry Ruth Anderson. She opened one door with the feminine face of God, and now she opens another. As she was just saying, the issue, she says, is not to find the map for becoming an elder, but to be the map. And she's written the book Ripening Time, a rich resource for all of us who wonder how to reach the true harvest of our lives. Sherry, thank you. Thank you very much. You've written an important book. I think it's going to help a lot of people.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
And listeners, if you want to follow Sherry's work or read more about her book, her website, as I said before, at the top of our interview is her name, and it's SherryRuthAnderson.com. Well, I want to remind listeners that you can catch any show from the archives. You can listen via iTunes as well. I want to thank you, my dear listeners, for tuning in every week. You are gas in my tank. And a shout goes out to Pat for sending me those articles about the nuns on the bus, and especially the Huffington Post article called Clitoracy, Clitoracy. Yes, finally someone has studied that sexual organ of women. Look for it, listeners. Just Google the word clitoracy. And I'd like to leave you with this quote from Monique Wittig. She said, it's one of my favorite quotes, "There was a time when you were not a slave. Remember that. You walked alone, full of laughter. You bathed bare-bellied. You say you have lost all recollection of it. Remember. You say there are no words to describe this time. You say it does not exist. But remember. Make an effort to remember. Or failing that, invent." That's Monique Wittig. Well, I will be on vacation next week, my dear listeners, and I would just say please check out some of the great shows in the archives you've probably not had time to hear. And I will be back with you on September 18th. I'll have Wenke Braithen with me discussing Mary Magdalene and Jesus, followed by Isadora Forrest discussing Isis, Lady of Magic. And I think that will inspire me to play this closing bit of music by Diva Haley in honor of Isis, called Isis. Enjoy, my dear listeners, and please have a great weekend. Be safe, stay cool, and remember, I will be back with you September 18th, and I hope you will check out some of the wonderful stuff in the archives in the meantime. Here we go, Isis by Diva Haley. Good night.
The veils now. How many more lifetimes will you donate to the illusion of the ego? Are you ready to directly face the truth of your essential self? It is time to set yourself free.
Name your soul will start to ring. I just
the fierce,